Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. My guest today may not be quite Maltese, however we fully appropriated him for us and I don't think he dare admit that he's not actually Maltese in origin. A great favorite amongst our music-loving public, indeed worldwide, he is a conductor, pianist and organist of great international repute. He has performed widely in all of the principal concert halls and opera houses, both as conductor and pianist, and sometimes simultaneously. He is celebrated for his interpretation of Gershwin and Bernstein and other 20th century composers, however his repertoire is actually far greater than that. His achievements have earned him numerous plaudits, and earlier this year he was honoured with an OBE in Her Majesty the Queen's New Year's Honours List. Wayne Marshall, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, nice to be here.
Wayne, take us back to the beginning, to the pre-Malta Wayne. Where did you live growing up?
Well, I was born in the UK. My hometown actually is Oldham, which is near Manchester, the county of Lancashire. And I'm a child of Barbadian parents. My parents emigrated to the UK in 1957 and settled there in Oldham. And, you know, we've always been, you know, music has always been part of our family because my parents both amateur musicians, I should say. I also have two sisters who are also professional musicians. So music has always been in my in our family from the very beginning. And so, you know, when we, as I said, you know, my hometown was a great hub of musical activity when I was growing up. And then I went to Manchester in 1970 to 1971 to study at Chetham School of Music. And, you know, from then on, that's basically how it all started.
So what is your first memory of playing music?
Well, my mother, in fact, was playing the piano when I was very young. And I was always very keen to, you know, to emulate what she was doing. I was fascinated by this, by the sound of what she was doing. So I always wanted to try and copy what she was doing. So, of course, I used to always interrupt her practice sessions, you know, if I wanted to play these pieces, you know. So, you know, I was just very over keen as a youngster. And I suppose it was just that it was a kind of natural way of learning. I mean, I didn't learn to read music till much later, but I had a good ear and, you know, picked up things very quickly. So it was, you know, it was a very interesting situation.
So after Manchester, where did you go on to study?
After Manchester, I went to London, to the Royal College of Music, and I was a student at the Royal College of Music for 4 years. In conjunction with that, from my second year till the end, I was then organ scholar at St. George's Chapel in Windsor Castle. So I combined the two. Basically, organ scholar was basically being an assistant organist. And so for me that was a very interesting role because, I mean, it was a professional situation. Every day I was playing for the services, working with the choir, and I mean I also had a flat in the castle, which was nice. So, you know, commuting to London was very easy because, you know, the trains were very fast, and so it was just a nice combination to make these two situations work well, and it did work.
Okay, Wayne, let's hear you play an improvisation on The Lonely Goatherd. So when did your international career take off?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I've been, you know, from school, I mean, I'm 71, I suppose, I was, you know, performing all the time, and in London I was performing, and then what I didn't say at the beginning was that I went to Vienna after I left London. That was back in 1983. Spent 6 months in the Hochschule there, and then I suppose that's really when the things started, because then, of course, I was on my own and had no, you know, had no money, and, you know, so it was a real struggle for, you know, a few years, and I did some teaching, and then it was, then 87 came, and then things changed dramatically then.
Would you say there was an actual moment where you got your lucky break, or you were spotted?
Well, I think the lucky break in terms of you know, my career sort of, you know, establishing itself happened really in 1986, when I went to Glyndebourne Opera in the UK, and I was chosen to be the repetiteur, and also to play the role of Jasper Brown in Gershwin's opera Porgy and Bess. Before this time, really, I mean, my career was mainly in church music and organ music, so I never really contemplated really a career in opera or orchestral, in the orchestral world. So this is a very big introduction for me, because I, you know, as I arrived there, and in fact, my sister took me down to play for her audition for Porgy, and she got the part. But then they were also very interested in me, because, you know, they didn't have the role of Jasper Brown cast, and so that's the role of Jasper Brown is the onstage pianist, like the bar pianist who plays at the very beginning of the opera, and then, you know, is finished with the right. And so, yeah, I mean, I got the part, and then, you know, we at Glyndebourne, they have a great reputation for really rehearsing everything very, very thoroughly. So we were there for about 6 weeks of rehearsals, and, you know, so really got to know the opera, and, of course, you know, being the repetiteur, which means basically I'm the pianist for the opera, which meant that I play the orchestral parts. So, of course, I really got to know the opera. And the very famous conductor, Sir Simon Rattle, was the music director then for this production. And at the same time, actually, Granada Television, which is a UK, or which was a UK independent channel from Manchester, were actually making a documentary about me. And so Simon actually spoke on this documentary, and actually he said something like, you know, in 10 years, you know, you'll have a bet that I will be conducting. But I mean, I had no interest in conducting, never even thought of it. But actually, 10 years, it happened that I was actually conducting.
What is it that he saw that indicated to him that you had a future as a conductor?
I think he could sort of detect from, by the way, I was playing the piano, because, I mean, you know, to play an operatic part on the piano, you know, an operatic orchestral part, I should say, you need to have in mind the kind of sound and feel of how the orchestra, you know, plays it. So it's not just a question of playing the notes, it's a question of, you know, the whole, where how you play it, and try to reproduce or replicate the orchestral feeling in the piano part, if that makes sense. So he could sort of see that. And then, of course, you know, my temperament is such that, you know, I tend to maybe have my own ways of views of tempo, and maybe, you know, we would disagree, or, you know. So there's all these sort of things. And learning to follow the conductor as well is a very, very important aspect. So, you know, he sort of saw that the seeds were there already, just waiting to be, you know, to be nurtured. And in fact, his management then became my management in London. And so that was a really great step forward. So, you know, it was, you know, I suppose the whole thing can really, you know, revolve around that Glyndebourne experience. And then after that, then becoming, you know, a member of the management in London, and then, you know, becoming a conductor and so on.
But you did mention that Granada was already making a documentary about you. What was the main thrust of this documentary? Why was it that they chose you as a young musician still?
It was something which happened because, you know, before I was, you know, living in London, and they wanted to, you know, because I'm a local boy, I suppose, and they wanted to make this documentary. And so they kind of followed me around a little bit. So it just so happened that Glyndebourne was a major part of this documentary. And of course, they filmed me in my hometown of Oldham, and in Manchester, and in St. George's Windsor, but not in Vienna. So it was a very good, you know, a very good thing to have done, actually. And it really worked well in my favor. And so, you know, I suppose they were just curious to see what I was up to, basically.
If we were to fast forward, at what stage did you make Malta your home?
Well, when I met my wife, we met in the Cayman Islands, because Jennifer is the director of the Cayman Arts Festival, and I was a guest artist in the festival back in 2005, and that's when we met. And then it wasn't until about 2006 or 2007 that we actually came here together for the first time.
Of course, Jennifer McAuliffe is a renowned pianist in her own right.
Exactly.
With an international career. But of course, she's Maltese.
She's Maltese, yes. So, you see, I'd never been to Malta before. So when we first came here, I said, oh, we've got to come and live here. And, you know, we were both living in London at the time. And I'd really got tired of living in London. So, you know, coming here just seemed a really amazing thing to do. So we, you know, Jennifer actually has a flat here, and we stayed there. Then we bought our house, and then the rest is history, basically.
I did say we associate you with Gershwin and Bernstein in particular, and your interpretations of both are legendary. But are you still excited to, for example, conduct Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue? You've done this so many times with so many different orchestras around the world. What I'm trying to tell you is, how do you keep up this level of excitement?
It's all about keeping everything fresh. And, you know, every orchestra is different. So, I mean, I have my way of interpreting it. But, I mean, the thing is that it's all to do with, you know, the approach in the rehearsal period. I mean, some orchestras will be very adept to not having a conductor standing up in front of them all the time, and some not. So we have to sort of gauge it. But, you know, it's for me, playing and conducting these works are, for me, much better than actually having someone conduct me to play them, you know, because then I'm in total control of it, basically. And it's my interpretation that's there. And, I mean, orchestras, yes, are used to having someone constantly up there to wave the stick, to bring them in, to, you know, show them the tempi, etc.
So in this piece, you're actually playing and conducting, you're alternating, which is quite unusual nowadays.
It's not unusual, no, it's just that it's harder for the orchestra. It depends on the orchestra. I mean, what I tend to do in rehearsal is I tend to rehearse the bits that they really need to rehearse without me. So I show them the tempi, I show them what to expect from me when I'm going to get up from the piano or sit down to play the piano. In some orchestras, I always have to remind them in a kind of joking way that I only have two hands. So, you know, so it's always a fun process. But, you know, I never get tired of playing these works. I mean, I've played them hundreds of times, and but every experience for me is a new experience. It's fresh. And that's you've got to be like that, really. It's not, you know, oh, here we go again. You know, it's a fresh experience. And then in the concert, when it really takes off, then it's fantastic, you know.
But do you feel you know the music better than the composer himself? I mean, could you tell Gershwin a thing or two about his music?
No, of course not. He was the composer.
But you're experiencing it. You're interpreting it for so many times in all those rehearsals. Don't you feel that it's almost your piece of music at the stage?
Well, I make the performance mine, but Gershwin wrote the music, and it's my job as a performer to interpret what he wrote. I mean, the thing is that George Gershwin was a great pianist, and the first performance of Rhapsody in Blue, I mean, the piano part wasn't really written down actually. And so what I tend to do now is that the two great piano cadenzas that come in this work, I improvise my own cadenzas. And so that, in a way, is a kind of throwback to that. I always think about that first night when Gershwin played it, you know.
So he improvised because he hadn't written it down. Maybe.
Well, you know, it wasn't totally written down. I mean, he sketched things down, but I mean, the thing is, it wasn't totally. So I mean, it was really afterwards, and he then formulated it in a way, which then became the standard script, if you like, or the standard score. But, you know, just bearing that in mind, I mean, you know, to think that the composer, Gershwin was a great improviser, so it's fine to, I think it's very fine to sit down and improvise. It's a sort of natural way forward.
It gives you permission to actually do this.
I mean, a cadenza. What is a cadenza? A cadenza is a point in the concerto where the soloist is able to display his or her own sort of talents as a soloist. Cadenzas are normally written down by the composer, but it's a moment to showcase the soloist.
Now, from attending some of your concerts, my impression of you is that you tell stories. And you're a wonderful performer on stage, but not just in conducting or playing the music, but also in conveying the story behind each piece you're about to play. And I find that really engaging, and it helps us as an audience to really appreciate the music better. You kind of draw us in. Now, you're humorous, you can project your voice very well, and you're comfortable talking to an audience. Did you actually train as an actor as well?
As an actor? No. I'm not an actor. No, I think, look, it's about reaching out to people. I mean, the thing is that, you know, a concert is basically entertainment for the public, isn't it? That's the basic, you know. I mean, classical music concerts always have this can be very formal, and the audience that goes to classical concerts are a little bit more formal and sophisticated. But look, at the end of the day, it's about a performance, it's about entertainment. And so if I feel that I need to talk to the audience about the music, I will talk to them about it, and, you know, but in a very basic and simple way, not in a kind of, you know, academic, highfalutin way that, you know, loses people. I think it's very important that I communicate and say, oh, well, this piece was written because this, and look out for this, or, you know, blah, blah. I think it's very important. I mean, in a really sophisticated classical situation, the audience doesn't expect it normally. So it's quite nice, actually, when the conductor gets up and says something about the piece, especially if it's a piece which they don't know, or it's a new piece. Then it's quite nice to say something. Mm-hmm. Do you think?
Absolutely. I appreciate it greatly.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. And you just have to go out there and just talk about the music.
You always look like you're having such fun conducting and playing. But do you get anxious before a performance?
I don't get anxious as such. The only thing I really do get nervous and anxious about are the thunderstorms. Thunderstorms are my real, you know, that's my real weakness. I really don't like thunderstorms. I can tell you, there's one situation back in Prague, as conducted the Czech Phil, about 3 years ago, and there was a big storm looming. We all knew it was going to be, you know, happening. Of course, I was checking the weather. I mean, it was very hot in Prague. But this is a live television event, you know, and the concert started at 9, didn't it? And then, yeah, about 9:30, I went on then to conduct. And, you know, the sky was getting blacker and darker, and lightning was coming, and, you know. And they did say to me that someone from the TV would actually come and stop when they thought that things were getting a little bit, you know, out of control. But they didn't need to come and tell me, because I stopped the concert, and because it was really getting very dangerous. And we came to an appropriate moment in the piece where I was able to say, right, ladies and gentlemen, concert's over, it's time to get out of here, because in a few minutes, all hell's going to break loose here. So within 10 minutes of getting out, there was absolute pandemonium, you know. I'll never forget it. It was really some. I'm sure that everybody thanked me for it, because no one came to tell me. But I certainly wasn't going to be waiting for them to come and tell me, because if I'd waited, we would all have been really, you know. It was one of those situations. Yeah, it was an outdoor concert. Yes, in Prague at the as part of the summer festival with the Czech Philharmonic. It's an annual event. It's wonderful, you know. And but the weather had been very hot, and it was. You know, it was looming, and I knew it. And so, of course, I'm watching. And we had this great photographer there. He took this photograph, which when I look at it, it looks biblical, actually, in the way that it's, you know, there's this huge bolt of lightning in the background, and I'm conducting. And I wasn't actually looking at lightning, but I was actually looking at, some of the woodwinds. But it catches me looking. And of course, I'm holding onto my score, because the wind was getting, you know, quite ferocious. But anyway, it was an incredible situation. But yeah, but yes, no. I mean, for concerts, I don't really get anxious because I just enjoy the moments. But for thunderstorms, yes.
So it's a real genuine enjoyment that you're portraying.
Absolutely.
But have you ever had something go wrong, like a wardrobe malfunction, the infamous wardrobe malfunction, or anything else go wrong mid-performance?
Well, I mean, things do happen. I remember one concert in Dublin. I was playing the organ with a trumpeter friend of mine, and, you know, I'd rehearsed everything was fine, so sorted. It wasn't a live radio broadcast, but it was actually, you know, quite a big concert. And we started, and it suddenly became apparent that the combinations, all these things that you program on the organ, you know, to make all the different sounds, were not working. My goodness. I mean, it was really, I don't know how many hours I spent setting it up. But anyway, nothing was functioning. So, of course, I had to stop because, you know, I mean, I couldn't really continue because it's a very complicated program. It's, you know, lots of different changes of registration of sound changes and nothing working. So I had to stop. And we stopped for about half an hour. And it turned out that the battery that stores the, it's like the computer, all the memory, the battery for the memory, had failed.
Oh, my goodness. The one thing you wouldn't have anticipated.
The one thing you just didn't want to happen. So, and I think what happened was I had to reprogram everything from start to finish as best I could. Or I had to reprogram about 20 different combinations in a kind of basic form and just use those
in front of an audience.
In front of the audience. But I went on to explain. I said, ladies and gentlemen, I said, we have a technical problem. Unfortunately, the combination action has failed because the battery has failed. And I haven't got time to sit here now and reprogram everything, you know, because they're all waiting. I mean, it takes hours to do it all, you know, because you're practicing. Concert started at 7:30 and we had to get through it. We had quite a big program. So I just had to make, you know, just 20 different combinations, and then we had to start. And then it was all kind of a little bit kind of a hit and miss, but we got through it.
Let's go for a break while we hear Wayne Marshall play a Toccata Latino. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, conductor Wayne Marshall. It seems to me that you use social media as an extension of the stage. You're very audience-facing, and you keep your followers totally up-to-date about where you are in the world. You actually give some behind-the-scenes glimpses into the preparations leading up to a performance, and you sort of draw your audience in before you actually give the concert. Why do you do this? Are you reaching out to educate your followers, or is it the other way around? You depend on your community of followers to give you this energy.
No, you mentioned about social media. I mean, of course, you know, because of the pandemic, back in March 2020, of course, was a moment for everybody. So, of course, I had to adapt because, you know, all my concerts were cancelled. And I knew nothing about social media, really, because I'd never really used Facebook or anything like this. But I've always been keen on recording. So my wife, Jennifer, she said to me when I returned from Moscow on the 11th of March, said, that Sunday after, said, you're going to go live on Facebook, do a concert. I said, what? So how? I said, how do I do it? And then we found this software, OBS, which is a free broadcasting software, which you can download on your computer. And I figured out how to use my audio recording equipment into this. I didn't have a webcam. Well, maybe I did have a webcam, a very old webcam, no lighting, and went live on that Sunday and just did a kind of improvisation concert. And I did another one the following week, And, you know, it became apparent that I needed to get some better equipment. So I started, you know, investing in webcams, better webcams, and even more, you know, much better, more sophisticated webcams, and then lighting. And it really started like that. It became a weekly event. So because we never thought that this pandemic was going to last, you know, for years, did we? We all thought it was just going to be a little, you know, 2 week, 3 week thing. There was nothing. So I just decided to continue. But anyway, it became apparent that it was not going to be a kind of week, you know, couple of weeks event. And then at the Anglican Cathedral here, St. Paul's, the Chancellor, Simon Godfrey, then had the idea to record the services for the Easter Triduum, which was great. And then I had the idea to do an organ concert, a live organ concert on Facebook. Just went live, you know. And then that took off, and then that became a weekly event. So, in a way, the answer to your question is that, in a way, this was forced upon me because I had to reinvent myself a little bit during the pandemic. And yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed it immensely. I still do it, and it's something about, you know, actually, when you're actually on social media, you're actually reaching out to a much greater audience.
Indeed. It's more democratic in the sense that, first of all, it's free.
Yeah.
So you can reach out to people who perhaps couldn't. And it's international in a big way.
And it's fascinating when, for instance, when I've been doing these concerts, and you get people, you know, writing in from Japan or Australia or, you know. And as a weekly things were happening, I mean, this was, you know, it was fascinating to read. Oh, people, you know, I'm just waking up now in Sydney. Oh, yeah, I'm here in, you know, in Togo. Yeah, you know, it's amazing. Los Angeles, you know, fantastic. And all these people. And then you start to build up the fan base, and it's another thing. But I think, as I said, you know, the most important thing about doing these podcasts or recordings is to do them well, you know, get some good equipment, lighting, good sound, good microphones.
For sure, gotta be. Otherwise you let your music down.
Well, you know, people are not going to listen. If it's a shoddy kind of setup, you know, bad sound, no one's going to listen.
What about the engagement? Obviously with social media, the engagement is immediate and unfiltered. People tend to just hit the keyboard. Has that been useful for you? Has it been uplifting?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it is like a live performance, isn't it? You know, going on social media and going live. It's like doing a live event. So that's how I've always treated them.
But with the difference that people are immediately reacting to it.
That's great. I mean,
engagement of the audience, is that important? Does it give you energy?
It is. In a different kind of way. Yes, of course. Because I mean, it's a virtual audience, and you know, it's a perfectly legitimate way of getting the message out. It's just that I just treat it as if there is a real audience out there, and that's the whole point. I mean, I remember doing the broadcast and. I mean, you know, I used to drive everybody crazy because, I mean, the house had a nobody was always looking like a television recording studio, cables, lights, microphones, everything. Because everything was always set up appropriately for the next week.
See, it's temporary until COVID's over.
I mean, the thing is that it's not like that now. I just come and set everything up when I need to. But it was nice in a way to have everything set up. But at the same time, I'd be testing everything, you know, constantly seeing, oh, how can I do this better or... You know, all these sort of things, and it was a fascinating discovery, actually, I'd say. And friends of mine, you know, I've got a very good friend in Seattle, and I sort of got him going on the same thing, and, you know, it's been interesting, always, how you involve people, and, you know, you find people who are interested in the same kind of ideas and want to help, and then they, you know, it was interesting, actually.
This really happened with a lot of performers. There was a great sense of generosity, of entertaining people, especially during lockdown, the enforced lockdown, the first lockdown when everybody was really frustrated about being locked up at home and everything. And that's when the entertainers came to the fore. They were, of course, barred from going on stage, but they entertained us in our homes. And it is an act of great generosity, and at the same time, it's a way of reaching out and really turning the world into a village.
Well, yeah, we were. I mean, I say we because I speak for my, you know, colleagues internationally. Because I mean, you know, we were, in a way, one of the first to be kind of shut out of halls, concert halls, and theatres, and everywhere else. But we found a way of getting back to our audiences and increasing our audiences. And it was a testing time. I mean, of course, financially it was a disaster for a lot of us.
Wayne, you live in Valletta, Malta's capital city, which is steeped in history and culture, and yet it has always been a place that buzzed with vitality. In fact, only a few streets away from your own house, there is Straight Street, which was party centre in the early 20th century Malta, with all the sailors on shore leave, carousing and drinking and dancing the night away. Can you feel this spirit of place, and does it affect your practice in any way?
I mean, Valletta is an exciting city, and it has become an exciting city, hasn't it? I mean, you know, of course, during the pandemic, it was a very quiet city, but it has a lot to say for it. I mean, you know, it's nice that tourists are now coming back and you can feel that this energy and buzz is back in a way, not as it used to be, but I mean, you know, at least it's returned. You know, I mean, we're blessed here, of course, in Malta with having such great weather. It's one of the things that I really enjoy here. And the views of the sea, you know, are all around us. It doesn't take long, you know. So I don't take it for granted, but at the same time, you know, I just love this idea of having it here. But no, I mean, Valletta is a city that has a lot to offer, and I mean, it can be noisy at times when you want to record, and you know, there's a lot of the noise. But this is typical, I suppose. But I'll tell you that when the first lockdown was taking place, I mean, it was very exciting actually to be in the city because you could actually see it. You know, I mean, there'd be times when I could stand at the bottom of Republic Street and look up the top. There wasn't a soul around. And then he walked up. I remember on Good Friday taking my son for a cycle ride, and there was no one. It was in the evening. It was about 4:30. It was a beautiful sunny evening.
Like it never ever was.
Oh, you know, no, and it was beautiful to see the architecture. You know, it was wonderful to look, and I took lots of photographs, I remember. And just, you know, having, you know, my son just, you know, in Republic Street, took a photograph of no one around, you know, the back of him. It was quite dramatic, but it won't happen again now, will it?
Your wife, Jennifer McAuliffe, is a pianist of great renown, as we had occasion to mention, and I can see from social media posts that you are teaching your children music. How does it all work out in a musical family like yours, with both of you travelling to perform, but then when you come back and you meet up, do you have great celebratory private concerts at home?
Well, yes, I mean, it's what you're saying. I mean, yeah, Jennifer is a pianist, but, you know, I mean, she's not performing as much as she used to. I mean, because, you know, we have two young children, so, you know, I'm the one that does most of the travelling. And we do of course, you know, help our children, but of course they have music teachers as well, you know. But I mean, you know, music is constantly going in our house. I mean, it's wonderful when I come back and I can hear, you know, James is on the violin and Martin will play the piano, and I walk in, they both play them in different parts of the house. It's a very nice, situation. And so, you know, we are blessed to have, you know, two wonderful children who at least are, you know, very musical and are keen to continue in that way. Yes, it's great.
In fact, I saw you helping your son to learn scales, and it seemed like a really fun way to learn. Do you think it's essential for children to be taught music?
It is, you know, I mean, it's another language, and that's how we have to look at it. It's another language, and I mean, we, you know, music is all around us. We can't imagine a world with no music.
True.
It would be hellish, wouldn't it? And we all, in a way, we all sort of take it for granted. I mean, you know, this pandemic has certainly showed us in a way that, you know, that when culture is switched off, you know, it's a big problem. And I'm not just talking financially, but I mean, it's just, you know, it's a big thing when there's no music, no live music.
Yeah, it is a cliche, but I mean, art just feeds the soul.
Of course, and we all need it. Yeah. So, you know, this is why, you know, we have to.
Yeah. It's fun because obviously we appreciate greatly our medical staff, and where would we be without them, especially in a pandemic. But ironically, they were coming back and saying the same thing about the arts and saying, you know, we need you to perform, to create your art, whatever it is, whether it's visual or performative, because it's good for our well-being, for the mental well-being of a nation. And, you know, the appreciation was mutual. But with children, as they learn music, it is a discipline, and it's, you know, it has very, very set rules which they have to learn. Is there room for improvisation and creativity even in that early stage of learning?
Well, it's important that children develop an ear. You know, I think you know, they have to discover the sounds, and you know, they can only really do that by experimenting themselves. I mean, that's how I started. You know, I played by ear for 5-6 years before I started to have formal music lessons. But it's important, you know, to get that creative side of the brain working. Because you become aware of harmony, you become aware of rhythm, instinct of, you know, what's the right thing to do. I think it's important. You can't just shut that down by, you know, putting a piece of music up in front of you. You have to read it, you know, because then your ears don't work. They have to, your ears really have to work.
Mm. The problem is keeping it fun, though, for children at that age, I suppose, because, for example, with the visual arts, they're given a much freer hand, so they're almost not told, you can't do it this way, you have to do it this way. It's just anathema to say a thing like that. With music, there are very set rules.
Well, there are, yeah, of course. I mean, the theoretical side of music, of course, is very, very, you know, I mean, it's like grammar, isn't it? You've got to learn the right grammar, grammatical way to write and to play and everything else. Also, all these things. But how you create music is something that you can't really be taught. What's inside you that makes you create a piece the way you create it? You know, that's something that you can't really learn. You've got to really feel that and develop that as you hear more music, and then you begin to get your own way of expressing it. I mean, as I said, music is a language, and you have to formulate that language in a way to be able to express and to show what you want to get out there, basically.
Wayne, it's time to hear some of your music. Let's hear you play some Bach. Wayne, earlier in the year you received an OBE, and it's just the most recent in a string of international awards and acknowledgements. What do awards and recognition mean to you, and do they affect your music at all?
It's nice to be recognised, yes. My music always remains the same, though. It doesn't change anything. You know, it's just nice to have the recognition.
So where is your favourite place to perform in the whole world?
I don't have. Yeah, next question. That's like asking me what's my favourite food, what's my favourite composer. It's very difficult. These are very difficult questions to ask, because, I mean, there are lots of places that I enjoy to perform. If I had to choose one place in Europe, the Musikverein in Vienna is a fantastic hall for lots of places. But, you know, I mean, I've been to many concert halls that are all fantastic, and some not so fantastic.
Okay, let's narrow it down to Malta. Where do you really enjoy performing? And you've performed in various places, including in churches. You regularly perform at St. Augustine, I believe, just down the road.
Yeah, well, yes. I've not performed there, for quite a few months now because of COVID and so on. But St. Augustine's Church is a fantastic church, and it has a wonderful organ there as well. But most recently I've been playing a lot at the St. Paul's Anglican Cathedral here. So that's also another fabulous building and wonderful organ. St. John's Cole Cathedral is also fantastic. But you know, you asked me this question about where I enjoy performing in Malta. I mean, the thing is that what Malta really needs, of course, is a proper cultural centre, proper concert hall. So it really needs. It doesn't really have it. Nothing is really going to change until this is in place, because all capital cities in the world or in Europe have places of culture, where culture can perform. and Malta needs to have it. I mean, the Mediterranean Conference Center is a nice building, but it's not a proper concert hall, really. It's not purpose-built, no. So we need to have a proper purpose-built place.
Authorities, please take note.
Please take note, yes.
And finally, any big plans for future projects? I'm sure there are plenty, but any you can share with us, and particular any that are happening in Malta?
Not in Malta, no. I can't. I don't work here in Malta. That's the thing. I mean, I do perform here occasionally, but most of my work, of course, is outside Malta. But next year I will be conducting, new production of Candide in Lyon Opera, which I'm really looking forward to. That'll be next December. So I'm really looking forward to that. But before that, I have concerts everywhere, lots of concerts. At least the traveling is starting back again now. Going to Japan in January. It's been nice. Going back to Seattle, June next year. But I mean, in between that, of course, I have concerts mainly in Europe.
What's an average trip for you? About a week? Because you have to put in...
About a week, yeah. Flying, getting there, rehearsing, performing.
Do you have any recordings coming up as well?
Not at the moment. I tend to make my own recordings, you see. This is the thing. I tend to make my own recordings of pieces. And certainly I record all my concerts when I can. And I enjoy this. I enjoy this idea of making recordings, And it's quite fun. I mean, recording companies are not going to be knocking on the door of artists now to say, we want to record this. In a way, we got to try to do it ourselves. The music that we've heard in today's podcast has all been my own recordings. When I say my own personal recordings, I actually made the recordings myself using my own equipment, and they were part of concerts. So they're not actually registered recordings or commercially released recordings.
So thank you for sharing those with us. Wayne, I'm going to let you go. Thank you for being a guest on this podcast. It was so great to meet you and to catch up with you on your recent developments, on how you weathered the COVID period in a really positive way. And thank you for the music.
Thank you very much indeed for the invitation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.